Hey, Krista, we're starting, and so here we go. Tony, before I start where I think I want to start, tell me where you want to start, or tell me some of the things you were hoping to get out of today.
Mostly, I guess, like the prayers, and we were going to go over the holidays a little bit more. And there was one other thing, I just can't remember what it was.
It's okay if it comes up later.
But yeah, those right off the top, those are the ones that.
Okay. Let's start with the things I think that you're going to be examined on. And you can eat. I mean,
Sure.
it's yeah.
I'll take notes.
And it's a pizza. So, let's talk about Shabbat and holidays. They'll mostly quiz you on holidays more than Shabbat, but we'll go over them. As usual for me, I want to start with a fundamental sort of theological or spiritual frame for the whole thing. The fundamental frame may be obvious, but it's very elusive. It's deceptively obvious, and it's this. The point of having holiness in time, meaning that rather than the idea that an object is holy or a place is holy. So, examples of holy places and holy objects occur even in our own tradition, let's say in the Torah, where a vessel of olive oil could be declared sanctified, made holy for the temple. And then, if anything impure touches it, it's no longer holy. If an unholy person touches it, there's a problem. If you donated the olive oil, in other words, it was part of your tithe, then once you tithed it, it was declared the temple's and therefore holy. Holy meant it belonged to the temple. And therefore, if you were like, no, actually, you know what? I'm going to keep that jar of olive oil and give them a different jar of olive oil, you couldn't do that. That would be stealing something holy and replacing it with something else. So, like, it had to do with the designation of an object. And so there are a lot of holy objects. And the holy aspect of it, and maybe I'm pushing it a little too far, but to me, it's like it wasn't so much about the fact that the menorah in the temple, the candelabrum, was actually holy. Like, oh, it's a holy object. There's an aspect of that to it, but mainly it meant it belonged to the temple. The actual word holy means designated, so or designated for, meaning like belonging. The time it comes up is in the Jewish marriage ceremony. The way when you exchange rings, you say, you are now sanctified, you are now made holy to me, and I'm made holy to you. Now, in English, it comes out as like, you are sanctified to me, according to the laws of Moses in Israel. And it sounds kind of lame. Like, what? You're made holy to me? And it's best, I just see my laptop's on. And I personally think, well, whatever. That's not going to be personal. It seems to me like it belongs to. In other words, when when you exchange rings and you're like, you're sanctified to me and I'm sanctified to you, according to our laws, it means exclusivity. It means I can't sleep with anyone else and you can't sleep with anyone else. You are now designated for me only and I'm designated for you only. That's what it means. So it's not really a bit like when I don't think it's like, it's not poetic. It's not, when I look at you, you are so holy. Like, I put you on a pedestal. You are like God. I mean, no, it's just saying it's a designation. It's a designation of exclusivity. So originally we have this idea like objects are holy, but then certain holy objects have certain powers. Like, you can't step into the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum of the Holy Ark where God is held to reside. Or you are standing on holy ground because the temple used to be here. So holy becomes, this was the area designated for God to, you're now praying in a holy space. And we end up with a little bit of extra layers on top of the idea that it's designated for God. Now it becomes somehow magically powerful. And this becomes deeply rooted in our minds about holiness is a magical, invisible property of objects. And it comes from our own Torah. We have reasons to kind of go in that direction from its original meaning being designated. And so maybe the angels are here because we're in a holy place. And, you know, we're now in a graveyard, and a graveyard is holy ground or something. Although I'm still ignorant of the fact that my understanding is there's no such thing as holy ground in even graveyards, and that Jews even get that wrong. Like, we always want to add this magical, you know, quality to things. Let me say one more thing about that, and then I'll go into directing. One tangent is this. In the Torah, the book of Leviticus, the priestly book, the book about priestly things and holy objects, has a number of chapters, many chapters, devoted to the idea of holy and profane, not holy and profane, number of chapters devoted to that which is ritually pure, in Hebrew, tahor, pure, and that which is ritually impure, in Hebrew, tameh and tahor. These are almost always translated as purity and impurity, and you have to worry about impurity touching holy objects. You have to worry about a woman who's menstruating has impurity on her. And you have to worry that a man who's had a nocturnal emission has impurity on him. And when you touch a dead body, you get impurity on you. And this sounds a lot, it sounds like the idea of holiness and holy objects starts to get mixed up with this idea of impurity and purity. And it sounds like, and suddenly, you know, like, women are icky because they menstruate, and men can be icky because they have emissions, and bodily fluids are icky. And you can be impure. You can have impurity because you have any oozing from your surface. So, like, you have a skin disease or something, and you are impure. I believe, perhaps apologetically, in the teachings of anthropologists who explain that, and people read the Torah carefully, that these concepts are very badly misunderstood, again, wrapped up with the idea of the invisible magical quality of objects, of holiness and non-holiness. And a woman becomes non-holy because she menstruates, and they're dirty, she's dirty. And you become unholy through sex because you emit these fluids like semen. And people who are sick are unholy, they're unholy, they're dirty. And that's not really what it means. So my translation, to cut to the chase, is I'd like to translate tameh as time out, because that's the way it functions. So rather than saying it is descriptive of a quality that a person has. Rather, you should look pragmatically at how it functions. All it means is that someone who has touched one of these fluids is temporarily in a state of not, let's take the menstruation one out for a second. The other one's dead bodies and diseases and things like that. Childbirth brings on the state. It means that you may not participate in something that's public. All it means in the Torah, I'm putting besides sex and marriage, let's just put aside menstruation for a second. All it means, the childbirth, the nocturnal emission, the death, the sickness, it means that one may not go to the temple. You may not go to the public sacrifices, public eating, the public barbecues, the public banquets is maybe a great way to put the ancient sacrifices were communally roasted and communally eaten. So you couldn't go and get a slice. You couldn't go and pray. You couldn't go and be there in the temple. So in other words, the way it functioned was like maternity leave. So what I think I think it's obvious when you read the Torah, the one saying, when a woman gives birth, she is forbidden from going into the public functions. And to me, people say, well, this is anti-woman, it's misogynistic. I don't think maternity leave is misogynistic. I think maternity leave is pro-woman. I think family leave is pro-woman. I think how about grief leave? I mean, think about every time people think the Torah is archaic and out of date, especially on this topic, it almost beautifully translates into exactly what the Bernie Sanders of the world and Democrats like me are fighting for, which is maternity leave and grief leave. I think it's brutal. We have a society in which you come into contact with a dead body. You have to bury somebody you love, and you got to go back to work the next day. Most companies don't even have something called grief leave. It's not a thing. The Torah is saying, oh no, this is definitely a thing. And it's a human right that comes from God. Maternity leave, death and grief leave. The nocturnal emission is a little bit of a separate issue, but sick leave, what's the other example? Which is, you know, you're sick. You have an open wound. You have the human right, but even in the Torah, be a responsibility. You're not allowed to go out in public. I mean, if you say, you know what, someone just died, I buried them, but I'm going back to work because I don't feel like grieving, you don't get to do that. So that's why we talked about Shiva last time in our lesson. You have to. You can't go out for a week. That comes directly from the Torah. So that what I'm saying is that these things are not actually a magical quality of objects. It's not that women are dirty. Impurity, tameh, means you have to take a time out from being in public. You get mandatory leave, and you don't get a choice about it. And so it's not a punishment. It's a gift. So it's not a bad thing. You're dirty. It's a positive thing. In relationships, the issue of a woman being impure, all forms of impurity no longer apply today because we don't have a temple anyway, frankly. But we're all impure. Impurity is the whole world because we don't have a temple to cleanse the world of its impurity anyway. The only category that we retain of impurity is menstruation, and it only applies to having sex. While a woman has the blood of life upon her, she may not have sex with her husband. She may not have sex at all. And you can view that as, again, a misogynistic punishment for women for menstruating. But when you think about it, semen is a life-giving fluid. The menstrual fluid symbolizes life. It is basically, I don't think it's a thing about dirtiness. It is about the fact that a woman has a right not to be sexually available to her husband part of the month. And in Jewish law, the way the rabbis often understood this is obvious, which is you should learn how to be intimate with your wife in ways other than sex. And for example, like talking, like interacting, right? So it shouldn't just become that the way you only interact is through sex, so that it's not viewed as she's dirty, you can't touch her. It's viewed as you have to learn to have a relationship with her outside of just wanting to sleep with her. And for, you know, 4 or 5 days a month, that's the way it goes. Anyway, so I just wanted to get all that out. I'm done with my tangent. It's a big part of Leviticus. Back to holiness. So in terms of holiness and why we're here, the frame is this, which is that the greatest philosopher, Jewish philosopher of all time was a guy named Abraham Joshua Heschel. He wrote in the 20th century. And he was a genius. He was to me on another level. And his stuff is incredible. The way he explains it, which is now famous, is that Judaism in its essence is not a religion of space, it is a religion of time. And that is a statement. It's not really about the holiness of the temple and of objects. Overdoing the fact that objects have a holy quality is going in the wrong direction, like I just said. Like, you're overreading Leviticus, you're overreading the word holy. You think holiness has to do with, you go into the temple and you feel its holiness. You touch a holy menorah that the Chabad rabbi blessed, and you're like, oh, you know, my menorah is better because it got a blessing from the Chabad rabbi. Like, it's vibrating with magical power. And Heschel's like, all of that is what the Torah is actually coming to argue against. It's coming to get a way of finding divinity in material objects, and it wants to find divinity in time. And it's an easy slogan, but to actually fully absorb it is something that in a way takes a lifetime. And so we might say, you know what, this is sort of Heschel. the Romans built all these temples, and you go in and you feel the presence of Venus or the presence of Aphrodite, and you draw on their power. Or with Catholicism, you go into a cathedral. Oh, when Michelangelo is on the ceiling, I feel God's presence. And Heschel's argument, and I think he's right, is that the revolution of Judaism is that you don't feel God's presence in a space. That's misguided. It's idolatry. It's just you're going in the wrong direction. God is present in moments of time. And the moments of time have qualities. And that you want to be able to recognize the divinity in the moment, the quality of the moment, not the quality of a space, the quality of a moment, and how you recognize divinity in the moment. So, for example, it's a religion of the everyday and the ordinary. You don't have to go to synagogue or temple to feel holiness. And that's clearly in Judaism. Like, yes, we had a holy temple in the old days, but the whole Torah is about things like, where do you do the Passover Seder? At home. Where do you do a circumcision? At home. Where do you light candles and do Shabbat? At home. Where do you do holidays? Because we're getting to holidays and Shabbat. At home. Yes. Are there services? Sure. Services means you can, if you go to services, do your communal worship, but that's not really where you're making Passover. Passover is not happening in the synagogue. Where do you do Sukkot? All the holidays. In the sukkah, which is where? At the synagogue? No, only if you are too lazy to build one. You know what I mean? The truth is, your sukkah is at home, like you build a sukkah. Mm-hmm. All of it's taking place at home. So that it is a religion that's saying, hey, holiness is not a quality of the space. Like you go to the space and you feel God's presence. God's everywhere. God is in nature. Absolutely. You want to go climb a mountain and look down, hopefully you'll feel the grandeur of God. And you say, holy, holy, holy. But that doesn't mean that holiness isn't in your, you know, in your living room. Mm-hmm. It is. Now, it is everywhere because it's not about the space and the location. It's about whether you can feel the quality of holiness in the time in that place. And there are ways to do that. So one of the things I sent out, I don't know if you know if you read what I sent out, but I sent out a thing recently to try to explain. You're probably not on that list.
I don't think you're not.
So I sent out, the last thing I sent out was on what the purpose, in my opinion, of the three main blessings, or two main blessings at least, you usually do at home. The most common blessings at home are before you eat, you say what's called the Hamotzi. Blessed be Adonai, his presence fills the universe, who brings forth food from the ground. And another one you often do is when you go to sleep, you say the Shema. And you say I'll give you a chance for that.
Yeah. Before eating.
And there are a couple of different optional blessings, but if there's bread, you say the Hamotzi.
Yeah, so so Lerona always, when she wakes up in the morning, she always says a prayer.
The Shema?
I think it's
Moda'ani.
It's basically like thanking God
for putting your soul back in your body,
or something like this. Yeah, it's something she says like every morning. Mm-hmm. So,
before we get to blessings and prayers, I'll say that there are hundreds of different blessings you can do at home. And there's some more common than others. You have to pick what you're going to do and what's your practice. Mm-hmm. To talk about prayers, to talk about exercise. It's like there's so many different versions of it, and there's not only one version in Judaism in terms of like what you're supposed to be saying when. Mm-hmm. But I'll finish that thought, which is if you make a blessing before you eat, and you make a blessing when you wake up, and you make a blessing before you go to bed. Those were some of the things I shared. I actually argued, what's the purpose? Is the purpose to be like, God, you know, got you covered. I know you're the big power responsible for everything. Like, thank you. Is the purpose to sort of give God God's due? And I don't think so. I think what Heschel's saying is the purpose of blessings is to identify the quality of the moment that you're in and the opportunity that it represents. So holiness is a quality of time, because times represent opportunities. And you have to know, you don't have to know, you're striving to create opportunities for godliness in time. So, for example, just like saying grace before you eat, if you, you know, let's say you're Jewish or not Jewish, doesn't matter. The dad or the mom who says, wait, kids, everyone shut. Before you touch the pizza, the spaghetti, we all got to say grace. So for anybody, there are two ways you could go with that. One is it's completely automatic, kind of like, we better do that or we're going to go to hell. Or we better do that or God's going to be angry at us. Or we better do that or our preacher's going to be angry. No, it's not supposed to be an automatic, like, good boys and girls do it and bad boys and girls don't. Mm-hmm. It's not supposed to be that. It's supposed to, by invoking the name of God, you're identifying that the mealtime has the possibility of being a holy exchange. That rather than being like, oh, guys, the food's out, mom made the food and everyone chomps on it, or whatever, you're identifying, wait a second, we all live busy lives. My kids are busy too. They're, you know, now that they're older, they're in their room, and I don't get to, we're all going to sit around a table, and this is an opportunity we can either waste, which is like, you know, hey, you know, Johnny, I noticed he didn't take out the trash, blah, 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 blah. You can waste the opportunity. The blessing invokes God's name to say, this, there's a, the quality, there's an opportunity, just use the word opportunity. There's an, I'm creating an invitation to myself and the rest around us. It's not like a tip of my hat to God for being such a swell fellow. It's rather an invitation. It's a reminder to ourselves that we have the possibility of creating connection around this table right now. This is a precious moment because we're busy the rest of the time. We're carving out a holy time or a special time in this day. And so, for example, one thing I shared a teaching of mine that's basically saying it could be a time of, like, giving advice where advice can be heard in a way that it can't be heard at other times. So I quoted a book that I have around here somewhere that basically identifies advice that helps and advice that doesn't help people. And what it basically says is if you have a child or a friend or a spouse or a neighbor or a coworker, and they complain, they say something like, Tony, that client of ours, what an asshole. You know, what a jerk. They're always so difficult. And you're like, well, you know, what you want to do is be like, well, yeah, but like there's ways to deal with them. Like you can totally, like, you know, I get along with them. I figure out how to work with them. You know what I mean? So what the book says is that when people complain about something like that, if you give them advice about how to deal with their client, it won't help. In the moment that people are complaining, they want validation for their frustration. So rather than say, oh, you know, I know that that person seems like a jerk, difficult client, but I've really figured this thing out about when you work with them, just try this with them. It really, really works. They don't really want to hear that. They'll clench up while you're doing it. They may hear what you said. They may not, but they're not receptive. And what the book says is that the thing to do is to validate in that moment. And you say, you know, I know. I've worked with them before too. Whoa. You know, I'm always like dreading that I'm the one sent out to help them on that call, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, I know that's really tough. And what they, you know, and the person wants to feel like they get to complain and they feel validated that they, that was really difficult. And be like, I know, I've worked with them before. It can be very difficult. I'm really sorry. You wait to give your advice. And what the book says is the times that they identified are around a meal at a mealtime. Like, let's say later that day, you're having lunch with that coworker and you're like, oh, you know, I was thinking about what you said. You know, I learned this trick about dealing with that client and it seems to really work with them. And you know, whatever it is, you know, I call them in the morning, always see them in the morning because they're always tough in the afternoon or whatever it is, or I'll butter them up with this thing or whatever, or, you know, and you don't do it in the moment. You shared it at mealtime. Another time they said was bedtime, if it's a family member or something. And then it started to strike me that this is when we do blessings. We do a blessing before we eat, and we do a blessing. It's not a blessing. It's a prayer that you do when you go to sleep and when you wake up. Lerone does one when she wakes up, mm-hmm. and there's one that we're supposed to do when we go to sleep. And so in a way, what the blessing is doing is identifying. I'm carving out a special time right now that's an opportunistic time. In things like the I Ching and stuff, they call it auspicious. This has the potential to be an auspicious time, a receptive time, a time where someone can hear me, a time where I can hear myself. Like, I put my kids to bed, and you will too, right? It's a very, getting them up in the morning and putting them to bed at night, they really are holy times. But it doesn't have to be holy time. It can be like, hey, wake up, you're late again. This sucks. Oh my God, we're already 10 minutes late. Oh, just get out of the bathroom for Pete's sake. You can chase away that holiness. You can chase away the quality of the time. But the reason we pray was not to do a reflexive automatic action. It was to identify that there's an opportunity in the quality of the moment now. That not all times are the same. Mm-hmm. Not all times are equally ordinary. There can be extraordinary moments. And you help create them through religion, through mitzvah, through word. So some of them are through everyday blessings, like when you say grace, whether you're Christian or Jewish, but what you're kind of doing is, instead of saying, thank God who brought me my bread, my food from the ground, well, actually, God doesn't necessarily bring food from the ground, or maybe it does bring food from the ground, but it's not like some theological exercise. It's like, it's kind of calming down the people at the table to be like, and it's a reminder to myself, right, to say, don't mess this time up. This is special time. This is precious time. There's a quality. God said mealtimes can be special. And I'm just being like, I can make it negative or positive. So I think that the point's obvious. And I'm willing to open it up. But then the next question is, so what's really going on is not a terrain of cathedrals, pilgrimages, like the Hajj and stuff. It's not about the pilgrimages and the places and the trips. Or for me, my temple is nature. I got to do nature. Because I'm like, nature is a temple. So is your home. So is your car. The car can be an amazing place. You know, listen, anyway, you know what I mean? So, like, don't overdo it with my temple is nature. It's the time. Time is a terrain. And it has ups and it has downs and it has flows. And Judaism is trying to help you carve out the quality of it and to create moments of opportunity for God's presence. That's basically what it's doing. So it's not holy objects, it's holy moments, it's holy times.
Yeah, and so with that, like how I kind of view it is, when you're eating, it's a time of nourishment that you're providing to your body. So you're basically, without even being consciously aware of it, you're already receptive, in a sense, to, you know, taking things from others. I mean, you're taking food from maybe, like, whether it was your wife or your husband or brother or sister or someone that created this food, you're receiving that food from them. So you're already in a state of receptiveness. And so, yeah, it is definitely
that is awesome.
A place of nourishment, you know?
That is so interesting. I love that.
Yeah.
That's right. One of the things I think is the Hamotzi blessing, there are different blessings on different kinds of foods, but the main food blessing is Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz, God who brings forth food from the ground. And especially like finished food, like lechem means like not like a raw carrot, although it can, but it means like even bread. Means mm-hmm. lechem. So one of the things I often think is that it reminds me of it reminds me of interconnection. Because how does God bring forth food from the ground? It involves, I'm looking at my piece of pizza, a cow. It involves the grass, God willing, instead of corn or whatever. You know, it involves dairy farmers. It involves people who grew the wheat. It involves the people who picked the wheat. You know, it involves maybe Mexican immigrants, because I don't know what we would do without migrant labor. And it involves the truck driver and involves all that stuff. And so what you're doing is, like you're saying, because when God brings forth food from the ground, it's a very subversive prayer. It's kind of like, wait a second, that's the one thing God doesn't do, right? God's not driving a truck. God's not milking a cow. Like, what a weird thing. God does not bring forth food from the ground. People do. And so it's a prayer that's like subverting, being like, yes, God is working through all of those people. you are part of this whole interconnected ecosystem, or you would not have a piece of pizza, because pizza doesn't come from the ground. Mm-hmm. And it's not a matter of, well, you didn't put it in the oven yet. A frozen pizza does not come from the ground. So, like, it's a reminder also to me of the animals and the immigrants and the people involved and the people who are working people, and how they're all part of God, and we're all interconnected. That does help me in terms of identifying the receptive quality of moments, which is, we're all part of this one fabric, mm-hmm. you know. And I love what you said. I mean, what you said is even honestly in a way better, because it's like about being receptive to taking things in. I love that. But also receptive to the fact that we're all in the same story. Mm-hmm. We're all part of the same story. We're all part of this. We're all going through the same things. And let alone the fact that the Torah is very, very concerned about those kinds of categories. Women, immigrants, workers, laborers, that they're not abused, that they're part animals, that they gain dignity.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
I think it's a beautiful way of looking at it and saying, yes, these are the holy, like, these times are surrounded with holiness. Because when you think about it in terms of when you want to get any type of therapy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to massage therapy, they create this environment. They put on the most tranquil music. You know, they try to create the best state of nirvana for you, so that you can really just relax and your body is receptive versus being stressed and tensed up. Because if you try to massage somebody when there's a lot of chaos and going on outside of them, that's the surrounding environment, they're not going to be as receptive to what you're trying to give them. So the idea too, that when you're having a meal and you're making a point to identify and create that moment of time as a holy interconnection with, where it be your family or friends, it's also a place to kind of like bring therapy from with each other through like you said, invoking God's name. I mean bringing that in, bringing God and putting God the center focus, I think that's the ultimate goal, is to say, you know what, we're always busy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time that we can take to really say, you know what, God, thank you. And if there's anything else that we can, you know, provide and put on the table, let's do it.
I love it. You know? No, that's so well said. No, really. I think that's the nail on the head. And so before we get to the holidays, sticking with that, like, I've been concerned that this is going to be a bad answer for one of your questions, and that this is going to be an ongoing discussion. But what the role of which prayers you do during the day and when, you know, I mean, their rabbis will be like, okay, here's your list, you know, do 1 through 100 every day. There's a theory that there are 100 blessings to do a day. But you, obviously for me, I'm much more free-floating than the idea that we can follow a script and be holy. But the main times are, the main things are that when you wake up, there is a little one-line prayer that says, of gratitude that God's put my soul back in my body, and it's a beautiful one. It's customary to say the Shema in the morning, you know, listen, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And it's, you know, right there. It's one of the conversion blessings. It's our one line of Jewish creed. Then, you know, there are all kinds of blessings you could do over washing your hands and this, that, and the other, but I want to stick to the main ones. The main ones are, the goal is to pray 3 times a day. So you find a place to say what's called the Amidah. And I think I want to do that later, but you find a place to say the silent prayer. If you can, 3 times a day, it's hard to get to. And the 3 times would be morning, afternoon, and evening. And if you can, you do it with a community. You find a community to go to, or you do it yourself. And we'll talk more about what that is. They have the blessings over food. There are blessings after food to do, and that's something else we can talk about. And that's already a lot of praying. And then blessings, you say the Shema again when you go to bed. And you mark the going to bed period. The transitions of morning and evening, I think, are especially vital for obvious reasons. And maybe I should just ask you what you think they are. But in one of the Psalms, in the Shabbat Psalm, which we say a lot because we're here on Shabbat, the Shabbat Psalm says you should, in the morning when you get up, you should speak of God's love. And in the night, when you should go to bed at night with words of loyalty. And or faithfulness. And the main thing that I've spoken about here many times is that it wasn't really till I had kids, although I should have realized it beforehand. There was really, I mean, maybe I did realize it beforehand. It only came into focus when I had kids. Is that the level of gratitude and positive energy and all of that stuff you have in your life is vitally connected to how you get up in the morning and how you go to bed at night. And it would have made sense to me before, but you set the weather. You set the weather of your day, of the quality of the moments of your day. It is really easy to wake up and just be like, oh, I'm already late. Oh, I'm still tired. I didn't get enough sleep. Oh, I have to rush around and get the kids fed. It's very easy to start with negativity. And to go to bed with, oh, they're not getting to bed on time. Oh, they need one more story. Oh, you know, we didn't get to bathe them. Oh, they still have soap in their hair. You know, they didn't eat enough today. They didn't have any vegetables today. Negativity. Like, it is so, so easy. And it is a very clear example of what Heschel's talking about, which is, what quality are you going to give that time? And this is an auspicious time, meaning that this time is what I mean, I've always wanted to know what the word auspicious means. I used to do I Ching and stuff like that. So it is an auspicious time for you, Tony. And I'm always like, oh, that's awesome. What's auspicious, mm-hmm. right? And so the way I take it is that it is a time of great possibility. And so beware. Like, it's a time that it can go in either direction. You know, keep aware of the signs. And that's true. You start your day and the day of others in your home with the net, with the the stress, the anxiety, and it can consume your life. It is an auspicious moment. The quality you give it will set a tone. And going to bed, not only for your dreams, but the morning sets the tone for the day. The nighttime is kind of the way it produces the reflective narrative of your life. In other words, when I think, well, what's my life like? I'm almost stitching together the thoughts I have before I go to sleep. Which is, oh, I never have enough time for anything. Oh, I never this, I never that. Oh, it's too much work. Oh, you know, oh, I have to work tomorrow. It's supposed to be my day off. It's sort of like the nighttime is kind of when I think, what was my day like? What is my time like? So it's kind of where I form my reflective awareness of life. And if you have to don't worry about taking a call, but take a break.
So oh, no, yeah. I'm just getting text.
No, it's okay.
Go ahead.
No, but if you do, let me know. We can always take a break. So anyway. That's what I mean by the idea of religion being about helping with the quality of time, and that sometimes really are more auspicious than others. And the prayer does reflect it in a way, not like I better pray so I get checked off by God, but rather in a way it's about this interaction of the holiness and the quality of time. Before I get back to the home prayers, let's do the holidays. Okay, so here we go. We're gonna do. This is what they're gonna focus on when you get there.
Okay.
The main holy times are Shabbat and holidays, and we'll start with holidays. Okay. In a lot of ways, I'm going to start in a weird place. I'm going to start with Passover.
Okay.
Even though you would think that Rosh Hashanah, New Year's, is the first holiday, not according to Jewish tradition. The first holiday that we ever kept really was Passover, because we were just freed from Egypt. I mean, we were doing Passover actually before we were freed from Egypt. It was the Seder that we had in Egypt prior to the death of the 10th plague, or during the 10th plague, and then leaving Egypt with matzah. So according to the Torah itself, it's our first holiday. And even in Jewish time, it's considered to be the beginning of the year, is just before Passover. So a common misconception, it's not that important a misconception, it's not that big a deal, Most Jews think that the calendar, in a sense, starts with Rosh Hashanah, but really the calendar starts with the month of Nisan, the month of the Exodus. So what does life start with? I'm going to give you the simple and the complicated. The simple would be for the exam, and the complicated is to reflect on at your leisure, right? Mm-hmm. The first holiday, Passover, the main symbols, the main symbol is matzah and maror. Those are the main symbols, which is that it's the holiday, it's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It lasts a week. You may not eat any chametz, which is a Hebrew word worth knowing. If you do flashcards for your conversion, like I did, or you're getting Liron to quiz you, or you're quizzing yourself, one would be maybe what chametz is. C-H-A-M-E-T-Z. Chametz is any leavened form of the five species of grain. And the five grains, according to Jewish law, are wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye. Any form of wheat, barley, spelt, oats, or rye that is not unleavened matzah is forbidden on those 7 days, even in microscopic amounts. The Torah says a fiction. The Torah makes up a children's tale to say that the reason we don't is because we rushed out of Egypt and didn't have time for the matzah to rise, for the bread to rise, and so it was unleavened. But the reason that the rabbis or many understood is that that's more of like a kid's story, is that unleavened bread, which was served in the temple, by the way, we used to sacrifice unleavened bread to God along with leavened bread. So it's a long-standing staple of our shepherd nomadic ancestors, is unleavened in addition to leavened. I believe that originally matzah looked much more like flatbread, like flat pita, that it had not risen, and looked much more like flatbread. I don't think it was as gross as the cardboard matzah we have today. I could, you know, a historian could tell me I'm wrong, but matzah is a form of nomadic traveling bread, which is what the Torah is saying. The Torah is saying when they were going to leave Egypt, they packed matzah. They didn't pack leavened bread. And that makes sense. Leavened bread would smush. And they had their simple... Unleavened bread is considered to be modesty bread. It's poor man's bread. It's lechem oni, the bread of the simple poor man, as opposed to fancy leavened bread. The main idea of Passover is we remember our humble roots as slaves. And we never, and the rabbis even say, in a sense, that the leavening of bread represents arrogance. So that is the basic idea. It's not so much, well, the bread didn't have time to rise. It's that leavening represents arrogance. And that by eating unleavened bread and eliminating all arrogance from our diet, that includes beer, by the way, because that's a leavened form of grain. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to eliminate arrogance from ourselves. And we do it through diet, like not even through prayer. It's an amazing thing. We do it through diet. We eat simply, and we eat the simple bread of the poor person. And that is incorporated into the Passover Seder. So Passover is matzah, and it's a Seder. And the Seder is a special meal where you eat matzah and you eat maror, M-A-R-O-R, which means bitter herb or bitterness. And the bitterness is a reminder of the bitterness of slavery and affliction, of suffering. I'll say one more thing about Passover, and I'll move on to the next holiday. Mm-hmm. if someone wanted to take a very simple approach and say, tell me in three words, what is the main value, human value, that Passover teaches? It would be the freedom from oppression. And I recommend knowing those three words or the Beit Din. Because the Beit Din is often interested in short answers to show that you know what you're talking about. Like, they're not really interested in essay answers. They're just interested that they know that you know what you're talking about. So, look. Passover week long, we eat matzah. We have a Seder with some bitter herb. Remember that we were slaves too. We weren't chosen because we're smarter and more gifted and special. We're chosen because God needed a people who understood how it was to be in hardship. And there's a value that Passover teaches. It's a universal human value, the freedom from oppression. It doesn't just apply to Jews. No one should be oppressed, meaning no one should be pressed beyond normal work and service. And it's freedom. It's a human right, the right to freedom from oppression. Okay. So you're going through the calendar. If the first holiday is Passover, you've come out of Egypt, you've connected with your roots, what's next? The next holiday is, it's number two, Shavuot. Very good. I'm sorry. You've come to Mount Sinai. By the way, I should say all of these holidays, most of them, have an agricultural basis to them that also represented the agricultural calendar of the ancient land of Israel. For some people, like my father and others, it's very important to know those agricultural features of it. This represents the first harvest, and this represents the barley harvest. I'm just not interested in all that because I'm not a farmer. Mm-hmm. But I totally honor the fact that the calendar has a parallel structure, which is agricultural aspects of the ancient of the land of Israel. Mm-hmm. But I'm not interested in those. Right. Okay. So Shavuot is a harvest festival. But the part I'm interested in is you've just experienced coming out of Egypt and commemorating the exodus from slavery with Passover, and now it's time, very quickly in the Torah, you come to Mount Sinai, cross the Red Sea, you complain a bunch for a couple of weeks, and then you're at Mount Sinai, and you get the Torah. Shavuot is the commemoration of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. And of us accepting it, but the gift of Torah. Revelation. Passover is about redemption. Shavuot is about revelation. We were redeemed from bondage, and then God revealed the Torah. One of the theories that has become very commonplace in Jewish tradition is that I don't know if I want to go too complicated into this. Let's just say this. One of the theories is that all converts were also present at Mount Sinai because it was a collection of souls, not just a collection of bodies. And so that anyone who becomes a part of the Jewish religion, even thousands of years later, they also have the status of having been present on Mount Sinai themselves for the original revelation. And it's just very important to the Jewish identity of converts and the way converts are understood within the tradition, not that they're a Johnny come lately to how cool Judaism is, but they have the same status as if they signed the Declaration of Independence themselves. Do you know what I mean? They have the same, that they were holding hands with Moses when the Torah came, they have that status. So that they have as high a status as is humanly possible or religiously attributable in the tradition. So Shavuot's about the giving of the Torah. How do we celebrate it? It's a one-day holiday. And one of the ways we celebrate it today is that there's a tradition that evolved after the introduction of coffee into the Sephardic lands of Turkey and so on, which is to stay up all night studying Torah or studying Jewish sacred texts.
Oh, yeah. So coffee was... So even then, it's like...
You need to study. You need coffee.
And you know, it's a fascinating story. So it's not a very old tradition, but it's a few centuries old, 5, 6, 7 centuries old. And we're going to try to do that this Shavuot as well here at the synagogue. Stay up all night studying, and then you do the morning service, and then you go fall asleep somewhere. I can't think of any universal human value that Shavuot represents, but it's a cool holiday. Okay. Next up. Shavuot usually occurs around Memorial Day. And so the next big holiday is going to be Rosh Hashanah. Oh, well, you know what? There's a minor holiday I should point out. In August, the next holiday, they won't necessarily ask about this.
What is it?
No, it's here. We had Shavuot.
I don't remember. I know it's like it's another S, like Shav.
I think. What do you think? Oh, Slichot. Could be Slichot.
Maybe.
I'll tell you what the next one is. The next holiday, though, I'm not going to include every little thing, but is Tisha B'Av, which is Hebrew for the ninth of Av. Okay. It usually occurs in August. And it is a historical holiday, meaning that you can still go to work. It's not a holy day, but you remember the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. You remember when Jerusalem fell to the Romans. Mm-hmm. And we do a candlelit ceremony about it. It's a sad holiday, and you fast. It's one of the two full-day fasts in Judaism. So the main thing about Tisha B'Av is the fall of Jerusalem and the temple to the Romans, and you fast. Because fasting is a sign of mourning.
So the fall of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem temple to the Romans?
Yeah, and the city itself. It was the end of the country 2,000 years ago.
and fast.
It's a fast day.
Fast.
That's it. I mean, those. I don't want to overdo Tisha B'Av.
So, that's how would you spell that? Tish.
T-I-S-H-A space B apostrophe A-V.
A-V.
Yep. Okay. It's the month of Av, the ninth day.
Gotcha.
Okay. So now.
Now we go to Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
Rosh Hashanah.
Then usually in September is you get Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur 10 days later. Together, these are called the 10 days of awe. A-W-E. Okay.
Together the 10 days of awe. Like, literally, like, awe as in, like,
Like, A-W-E, like, awe, wow. Like, okay. of wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, in Hebrew, the Yamim Noraim, the days, the awful days, the terror days, the days of awestruckness, of awesomeness, of being awestruck. So you're supposed to be awestruck for 10 days. So the idea is this. The calendar is a journey in time, right? When you think about it, Rosh Hashanah occurs 6 months from Passover. So think about like the Torah. You got freed from Egypt. A little while later, you got Mount Sinai and you got the revelation. And now it's basically 5 or 6 months later, you've had to live it. Question is, have you been living it? Have you been doing there in the desert with God? You got your Torah. You got your revelation. You got God. You got your people. Have you been doing your part? Or have you been like, nah, I'm a little too busy for all this. I'm a little too busy to be close to God. I'm a little too busy to be close to the Jewish people. I'm a little too busy to be bringing holiness into my life with a higher way of living. You know, I've been too busy just living life. So it's the Rosh Hashanah is the holiday about repentance, about turning toward God. So repentance is usually viewed as like going backward. But in Hebrew, the Hebrew word is, I'll spell it in English, T-E-S-H-U-V-A-H, Teshuvah, T-E-S-H-U-V-A-H. Many people translate it repentance, but repentance kind of sounds like, I better stop what I'm doing and go back. But Teshuvah means turning back toward your path. So it is like you're driving. It's not like, oh no, man. You know what? I had that Torah and the God and the community, and I kind of been driving out here in the wilderness, and I should turn around and go back. It's not that. It's more like, yeah, I need to like turn off onto an exit and find my way back to meet up with God. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very important metaphor to understand that you're not trying to go backward in time. You're trying to meet up with God, the community, and your soul, your own soul again. The way it's so Rosh Hashanah is marked by a couple of big things, and they will ask you these. You get back on the path with God through three T's. That's my way of remembering. The three T's are Teshuvah, T-E-S-H-U-V-A-H, which means getting your butt back into the path of God, turning toward God, okay, or repentance. That's the first of the T's. Mm-hmm. The second one is tefillah. T-E-F-I-L-L-A-H. Tefillah means sincere prayer. And the third T is probably a word you know, a Hebrew word you know. What do you put money in? What box? Do you have a tzedakah box at home?
No.
You should get one. You have a box. You should keep a box around for change and money in your home for giving to the poor.
I was going
to
say piggy bank, but I was like, that doesn't
yeah,
start
well, like a piggy bank. like a piggy bank for the poor. But anyway, okay. I'll just say this. The third one is tzedakah. It's spelled T-S-E-D-A-K-A-H.
Tzedakah.
Mm-hmm. Did you get it? Okay. Uh-huh. It does not mean money. It means righteous action. So, Rosh Hashanah is about having the awe to know, am I really walking on God's path? I need to walk back toward God, the community, and my soul, and the people who care about me. That's tshuva. I got to do some sincere prayer. And I've got to do righteous action. Okay. Now, a quick tangent, and this really is quick. A lot of people, and I'm included in them, will sometimes be found to make fun of people who only show up to synagogue 2 days a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So in Judaism and in Israel, it's extremely common for Jews only to go to a synagogue, to only pray 2 days a year. And like Christians here sometimes only go on Easter and Christmas, mm-hmm. right? Our Easter and Christmas is Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. They actually occur 10 days apart. You get it all out of the way in 1 week or 2 weeks. It's easy to mock that for me, but it shouldn't be made fun of because of what I just said, which is that if you can manage once a year, if you could really do what's called the High Holy Days, that 10 days, the days of awe, mm-hmm. if you could do that every year, you deserve some real, like, it can be very powerful. Let's put it that way. Even if the rest of the year you're not praying and you're not doing a lot of righteous action and you're just living your normal consumerish, busy, self-centered life, mm-hmm. if you took the High Holy Day seriously and spent 2 days of Rosh Hashanah praying and really searching your heart and your soul, really praying sincerely, and really trying to change your life and make amends. You know, what you and I call, what people call New Year's resolutions. Mm-hmm. But really take stock. You know, I'm ignoring what my doctor says. I need to eat differently or whatever. I'm ignoring what my wife says. I've backslid in certain areas. And for 10 days, I'm going to pray my heart out. And I'm going to make changes. It could change your life. It's a technology. It's a spiritual technology. It can change your life. So we talked about the quality of time. So yeah. You could say, hey, you should go to synagogue all the time, and you should pray all the time, and you should, fine, you should, all that stuff, right? But the bottom line is, there is this 10-day period, which is auspicious, which is that we create a holy time in which if you enter it, you can come out the other side transformed. And years pass quickly. And so I just want to point that out. So it's common to make fun of two-day-year Jews, and most of them are not taking advantage of it. But to mark that time as like, you know, if there's like a... If I'm talking about the quality of time, it looks like chutes and ladders, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is a major chute, or a ladder. I guess it's a major ladder, which is you're going along that game, and there's a ladder planted at Rosh Hashanah, and it's like, boom, and you're up here for 10 days. Whole life can change.
Yeah.
Your whole life can change. But people often don't do it. But that's the idea, is that these days, so the principle, the way they put that is this, in terms of the ladder going up to God, on the day of Rosh Hashanah, the gates of heaven open. And at the end of the 10 days, at the end of Yom Kippur, the gates of heaven close. And now you could say, wait a second. Shouldn't the gates of heaven be open all the time? You know, whatever. We can have theological conversations about how dare they say the gates of heaven aren't open on a Tuesday.
Right.
But, you know, but the bottom line is, what they're saying is, and this is like why Heschel is so good. You know what I mean? They're saying, don't think about this too concretely. But what they're saying, there is a quality of time where the whole shift of the cosmos is that this time is open and you have 10 days with the gates of heaven open. Are you going to use that time or not?
Right.
And can you examine your life and change your life or not? And figure out where you need to walk with God and make changes. Okay.
So, yep. Yeah, it's in a way like God's way of, I guess, kind of like, expressing the understanding of his grace to those individuals, but also to the ones who are quick to judge. Because he's saying, look, you know, this could be an opportunity for this person's life. You know, they spend that 10 days with me, they may change, come back and be, you know, doing what they're supposed to do every day of the year.
Right. That's right. Tshuva, repentance, is open to everybody. And it's very democratic that way. Okay, I'll give you more stuff for the exam. So what do you want to know about Rosh Hashanah? It means New Year. The gates of heaven open in synagogue. The main symbol for the holiday is the shofar. Do you know what a shofar is?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
It's a ram horn.
The blast of the ram's horn on Rosh Hashanah symbolizes two different things. It symbolizes the breaking of your heart if you really get to that deep place where you want to connect to God. You got to break your heart open to be like, who am I really supposed to be as a husband, as a man, you know, as a person, as a parent, as a Jew? You know, it's a time to embrace all of that, which is most of the time the Jews here are not religious, which is really a nice way of saying, I don't have to be Jewish,
mm-hmm.
Right? It's a clever way to say it. And like, that should be a time we rip open your heart and say, oh my God, I was born a Jew. I've been made a Jew. I've been drawn to Judaism. Like, I've got responsibilities. So like, anyway, the shofar blast is our opening of a heart, a heart breaking open.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a military trumpet call to charge. So in the Torah, you blow the shofar when you're going into battle, like do-do-do-do-do-do. And it's also a battle. It can be considered a battle against Satan, against the devil. And that symbolism occurs within the service, that it's also a time to battle the devil. So the devil is there saying, oh, come on, you're not really religious. Oh, come on. It's a lot more interesting to spend your time going to your kids' sports games and bringing your kids to synagogue,
mm-hmm.
and teaching them to pray. Like, it's a lot more fun to watch them dance and go to ballet and tap dance than it is to actually teach them, you know, holidays and make them go to synagogue. And so, like, that's all the devil. So, like, it's time to, like, fight the devil on that. So the idea is that the devil's there, and the trumpet blast is calling you to charge against them, to have the strength. Anyway, shofar for Rosh Hashanah and the three T's are the main things you have to know. Yom Kippur ends the holiday. It means the Day of Atonement. And it's where you have a fast that's 25 hours long. I'm going to give you the five forbidden things because they may ask you. They may not. What are the five forbidden things on Yom Kippur? It's the holiest day of the year. So that is important. Mm-hmm. The holiest day of the year is Yom Kippur. You're not allowed to eat. No eating. Drinking, sexual relations, luxurious bathing, recreational bathing. Or wearing leather items. And those are the five forbidden things. It's a holiday about apologizing and atoning to God and being forgiven to start the year fresh. You have a fresh start. I'm going to tell you something that is not going to be on the exam. But it's very important about the holiday, in my opinion, is the way many of the great rabbis understand the holiday is that what is all this fasting and all that stuff about? And they say, there's a custom of wearing white on Yom Kippur to synagogue. And the custom is a later custom, although who knows how late, I don't know. There's a custom, it's not a requirement, but there's a custom of wearing white clothes, white garments. I think that a beautiful way to understand it and the way many of the great rabbis of the Talmud did understand it is this. What the fasting does is not only puts you into a deeper place of prayer and reflection, which it does, but you're acting out a double drama through this holiday. One is the drama of being a corpse. Or someone on their deathbed. It's a death, let's put it that way. Acting out the deathbed. The deathbed is people stop eating and stop drinking. And I've witnessed it. It's one of the ways you know that someone's really imminent. Because there are people who are on hospice for a long, long time. And you're like, mm-hmm. And they're like, the hospice nurse says they could die anytime. They could die anytime. Usually the sign is when they stop eating or drinking. And so it is interesting that that happens before you die. I guess you could say it's obvious, but you actually see it unfold. It's very powerful. Mm-hmm. You're not interested in sex anymore. I mean, obviously. The leather thing, the bathing thing, you actually also not interested in bathing. But you're acting out, and we used to be buried in white garments, white, simple white garments. So you're acting out the fact that you're on your deathbed. What's important about that? Very simple. The whole drama of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is about the fact that you don't know how much health, you're mortal. You don't know how long you have on this earth. So it's like, what are you going to do at the time that you have? God does not guarantee that you live forever. Mm-hmm. So that you have to say, my God, do I really want to spend my time worrying about the SAT, my kids' SATs, whether the San Diego Chargers leave San Diego or not, you know, do I really want to worry, you know, be spending my time talking to my wife about things like, should we buy a gazebo for the backyard? Should we take our vacation in Mexico? I mean, like, what the hell am I doing? You know, I get this amount of time. So, like, you want to be like, what if I had the privilege of being on my deathbed and then being magically transported back to my body? Like, what's that? A Christmas Carol. Like, you know, like.
Yeah, movie. Yeah.
And it is, which is like. You're supposed to be praying like you're on your deathbed and you could be dying, and then you're given a second chance. Okay? The other I said it was a double drama.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is the rabbis say, who else doesn't eat or drink or have sex or wear leather or bathe and who wears white? Angels. So you're, okay. And by fasting and doing all of that, you are emulating the angels. What is the only thing that we know about angels for sure, about their nature? It is that they don't have free will. The mm-hmm. difference between an angel and a human is that an angel is programmed by God to do a task and cannot vary. So if an angel's if God sends the angel Raphael to heal you, it's just like a computer program. The angel goes, heals you, and goes back. Angels do not have any free will whatsoever. So that they are pre-programmed. And the idea is this. I have the possibility of following God's ways like an angel. I'm not a fallen creature. We have the ability to be angels. In other words, those people say all the time, like, this idea that, you know, the rabbi just gave a sermon about, and it doesn't matter what it's about. The rabbi gave a sermon about every time we sit with our kids, we should do this. Every time I'm with my wife, I should watch what I say and not get angry. Every time I have these bad habits and addictions and blah, blah, blah. But come on. We're human. Like, I can't be, I'm no saint, blah, blah, blah. No, we're not saints. Mm-hmm. But the whole principle of Judaism is the stuff that God we're being asked to do is all completely possible. So the idea that it's saying that we think we're so, because we have free will, we're fallen. We could never do. Like if I ask people, why don't you keep Shabbat? Why don't you keep the rules of Shabbat? Oh, like, they act like you'd have to be a superhuman. You know what I mean? Like, it's so hard. You mean, I can't drive anywhere? And I can't cook? And I can't watch TV? Like, I can't do it. I can't do it. You know, or the doctor that says, you need to eat healthy. You mean not have sugar and ice cream and pizza? And you mean, like, eat a vegetable? I can't do it. I can't do it. All the stuff that, like, Torah's asking you, it's all for humans. It's all to be done. Like, it's not hard. Praying? Me? Pray? No, I'm not like Mother Teresa or the Pope. I can't pray. Yes, you can. Like, people think it's for angels. By dressing in white and fasting, you're kind of saying, I can do it. All that, all the stuff, all the walking with God is possible for me. I can eat healthy. I can treat my wife with respect. I can be a better friend. I can be a better version of me. None of it is out of my grasp. So like an angel, I can follow God's will. So that's the summary, is that you're like a person on their deathbed saying, I really need to change. If I really understood how mortal we are, I would change like that. And also, if I understand how much like the angels we really are, which is we can actually follow God's will. Like, it's not hard. It's not impossible. It's not for other people to do. It's really, really possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of it is like going to the doctor. You know, everyone says, I can't change my diet, I can't change my diet, but I guarantee you, if you walked in your doctor and said, you'll be dead in a year if you don't shift your diet to nothing but raw soybeans, trust me, you would eat raw soybeans for a year. You know what I mean? Like that thing, oh my God, this vegan thing, I do, I'm a human, I could never do that. Your doctor says you're going to die if you don't, you do it. In other words, this stuff's not impossible. It's not hard. And so a lot of the High Holy Days remind me of like the doctor. God's the doctor. God's being like, you know, you want to have a marriage? You got to talk to your wife different. And you got to up your game with this, that, and the other. If you're like, oh man, I can't. Ugh. It's like, no, you can. You know, you really, really can. I mean, or get divorced. I mean, move on. Like this idea you're going to live in this middle area of not living up to your responsibilities and then you're going to die. You don't have to. This religion's not up in the sky for angels to give. Like you can follow God's will. You mm-hmm. really can. Okay. I'm going to finish all the holidays. I'm going to get there.
Now Hanukkah.
Okay. So No. Mm-hmm. We skip one. So if Rosh Hashanah happened and Yom Kippur happened at the sort of basically in September or early October,
mm-hmm.
4 days after Yom Kippur ends, you have the most important holiday according to the Talmud is Sukkot.
Oh, yeah.
Sukkot. a holiday that is virtually ignored today, but is incredibly important. So you've come out of, you're on this journey. You were redeemed from Egypt. You got revelation. You had 6 months to live it, right? Which is like the biggest, we're in like this big area where you're not like having too many holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to be like, wait a second, I'm going to die one of these days. I better really, really live it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I got some extra stuff.
Running out of battery.
No problem.
I think there's one right there in the middle. It'll fit.
That's true. I got to take this one out, though, because that's the cell phone charger. There you go.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. So then you get your so you're redeemed, you get Torah, you live for 6 months, you get the wake up call of 10 days of awe to be like, crap, I'm not really living it. I'm a faker and I gotta get with it. And then right away you head out of the super awesome 10 days of high level reflection and you live in a tent in your backyard for a week. The rules are you're supposed to eat in the sukkah, and if you can, you're supposed to sleep in the sukkah. And it's completely vulnerable. I mean, the top has the rain and the sunlight come through. The top is covered in branches. You know what a sukkah looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just try.
Basically like a shack.
It's a shack. And you think about it, you've come out hopefully emotionally raw and re-energized through the 10 days of awe. And now it's like you live outside. And it's so awesome because you realize what's important and what you really need. Like you're getting away from, you know what, let's put it this way. If you're supposed to go on a diet and you're like, you know what, I got to eat more salad and more, you know, and healthy and exercise. And then the next day you go home and you're like, oh, here I am in my house with ice cream and cake and pizza and chocolate. Candy, right? You're probably not going to keep your diet. Sukkot is a spiritual way of not returning to your normal life. So it gives you this transition where you've made new resolutions, you've prayed on things you want to change, and it takes you out of your typical home, your environment,
mm-hmm.
and sticks you in a shack outside. So it kind of is like, it's a way of, to me, it's a way of giving you a chance to develop new habits because you've created a new environment and an environment closer to God because you're closer to nature. That's all I want to say about Sukkot. And it's a week long.
What exactly... is the meaning of Sukkot?
So the word Sukkot is a plural, mm-hmm. refers to a sun shelter where an agricultural worker, it's sort of a handmade sun shelter that you put next to fields, agricultural fields. And it's where an agricultural worker gets out of the sun to take their breaks during the day. And during harvest time, they'll often sleep in them so that they can do the harvest full through in a couple of days. So, you know, like today, it's very, I don't know about today, where I grew up in Pennsylvania, it's very common to see a farmer's fields right next to their house, right? A little farmhouse and a field of corn. But even today in Pennsylvania, where I grew up, and even when I grew up, I remember that there was a farmer we knew. I'd say, oh, you know, so you have corn. And they're like, oh, I also have soybeans and more corn. I'd be like, well, where is it? And he's like, well, I have this land that's like 10 miles away. And you'd be like, oh, it kind of wasn't my picture of the landscape. You know what I mean? I'm used to farmhouse, barn, land, no trespassing sign. You know, back then, most of the farmland was, you lived in a village, in a mm-hmm. town, and the farmland was in concentric circles around. Your fields were far from your house, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Everyone lived in the village and your fields were farther away. So during harvest time, when you're actually harvesting your mature grain, you might as well just sleep in the shack next to the field, in the sun shelter, because you're going to want to work morning to night then you're going to be exhausted because it's summertime. It's super, you know, it's like these late hours. The sun's getting dark at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. You might as well just sleep out there, wake up in the morning, and keep harvesting. The other thing is it keeps robbers from stealing your harvest. You have fully ready-to-go ripe grain. It's worth something as opposed to green grain, which isn't worth anything. You pick a piece of corn before it's ready, it's worthless. So farmers would stay overnight for the security of their grain and the speed of harvesting it. And so that was a pre-done tradition. Now, the idea became combining that with, this is the simplest way to put it, Jewish farmers in the land of Israel are already doing this. They're living in their little shack, and it occurs right after Yom Kippur, right? The harvest comes right at that time. So the rabbis made a little bit of a fiction, which I think is sweet, which is they said, well, when you think about it, we wandered in the desert living in tents because we were nomadic people. Remember, we got Torah. We wandered in tents for 40 years. Our ancestors were all shepherds, and they lived in tents. Abraham lived in a tent. Isaac lived in a tent. They all lived in tents. And the rabbi said, in a way, when you're trying to get back close to God, you're trying to reconnect with our ancestors' experience in the wilderness with God and with our shepherds with God and King David singing the Psalms, which are all about being a shepherd out in nature with God. So they said, we know that these sun shelters that you build next to the fields, so you have a place to take a break from the sun when you're weeding and planting, aren't tents. But let's put the idea together. So they make up this idea that they say, well, you know, we lived in Sukkot when we were shepherds and when we were leaving Egypt and living in the desert. We lived in Sukkot. And they say that. But we didn't. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, we lived in tents. A tent is different than a sukkah. Mm-hmm. But they say it's close enough that it creates the same spiritual experience. So they say that we notice this timing. We have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and 4 days later, it's the harvest festival, and people are going out to live in their sukkah. How perfect is that? Right when we've like come back and made repentance and come close to God about who we need to be, you go out and you live in nature in a shack. It's like King David living in his tent. It's like Moses living in his tent. It's like Abraham living in his tent. So they say, think of it as your tent. And that's the religious connection. That's the reason we live in Sukkot is because our ancestor lived in Sukkot in the desert, which isn't true, but it's close enough. It's a close enough fiction that it creates a very powerful spiritual experience. That's all.
So if I were to say
the reason, so Sukkot is
in a short sense,
it is
like, what is
we live in a sun booth. It's sometimes called a booth. We live in a sun shelter booth because our ancestors did when they were close to God.
Okay,
that's it. I mean, you know what I mean. So we get close to God by living in one. Is someone here? Was that Becky?
Looked like somebody came and dropped something off. Or...
Okay. Anybody here? Okay. That usually happens, in October. The next big holiday is what you said. What's the next big holiday?
Hanukkah.
It usually occurs in December. Hanukkah is actually a day. Hanukkah is the holiday, as you know, of it commemorates the victory of the Maccabees over the Greeks or the Greek Syrians. But let's just say the Greeks, in approximately 186 BCE.
In what was the time?
About 186 BCE. the main issue was that Judaism was outlawed, and they were fighting to change that. There's a miracle that happens in the story. And the miracle is, or it says, the miracle that happens in the story is that the Jews win the war, even though they're hopelessly outnumbered. But under the Roman occupation, 2 centuries later, the Jewish leaders wanted to discourage rebellion, hopeless rebellion against the Romans. They wanted to discourage hopeless rebellion against the Romans. So they changed the miracle from a military victory to one about 1 day's worth of oil lasting 8 days.
So one of these is not actually true.
Yes.
And that would be the oil.
Yep.
Wow.
It's easy. All you have to do is get out that book over there, which is on my which is on the coffee table. I'm showing it to the teens today, and it is a Catholic Bible. And in the Catholic Bible, you can look up the Book of Maccabees, which was not canonized in the Hebrew Bible, so it's part of the Apocrypha. And if you read the books of Maccabees, there is no mention of the oil. But there is a mention of the fact that it's a miraculous victory. But the holiday was so popular that under Roman occupation, rebellion kept happening against the Romans by small bands of Jews who felt that they could recreate the miracle and kick the Romans out of Palestine, or Judea, I should call it.
Wow.
Do you know what happened every time there was a rebellion against the Romans? The Romans would massacre tens of thousands of innocent Jewish women and children.
Wow.
As punishment for disobedience. Actually, not just disobedience, for hubris.
La brute.
Thank you. The Jewish leaders at the time had to make a decision. We have a holiday that is almost new. It's only 200 years old. We had a victory against the Greeks, and God helped us win. But every time we try to do it now, the Romans not only win, unlike the Greeks, but they're massacring tens of thousands of innocent women and children. So the rabbis declare that it is not God's will that we recreate Hanukkah against the Romans. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
They alienate a whole faction of the Jewish population who is against that policy. It would just be like being in America today. I don't know. I'm trying to, I mean, it's a bad example, but
it would be kind of like this cause of the Civil War. Like, you believe that way and you don't want to believe this way because we believe it's not civil, not humane or moral, mm-hmm. or morally or ethically right. That you would condemn a man by color of his skin or belief, I guess, in a sense.
Well, I mean, you have to tell me. I mean, what I'm thinking is just something simpler like this, which is your country goes to war against someone, I don't know, and you lose. Like, Israel lost, right, against the Romans. But people are like, hey, you know, but in the Revolutionary War we won, or, you know, the last time we won, like, let's all fight. And yet every time you fight, the country that won just kills everybody. and then says, fine, you know, I'm not like, it's always popular. It's always more popular to be like, oh, like rebel. Like God will be with us.
So that could be, I mean, a good example for that could be the constant tribal takeovers of in Africa, the Tutsi and the mm-hmm. Zulu, or I think
Hutus.
Mm-hmm. Hutus. Yeah, that's what it is.
How so?
Because there's always the one greater tribe that was always deciding. So as soon as this tribe would finally establish some sense of peace or organization, civilization, this one tribe would always come and attack and try to overthrow it, like every time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they would always win.
Right.
Because they were always the more...
bigger.
Just bigger and more, I don't know, they're just aggressive.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, it was a straight up example, and it happens all the time, where the political leadership said, this is suicide to keep attacking the Romans. But the people are like, no, we can do it. And the leaders are like, no, every time you try to do it, they come in and massacre people. Like, responsible leadership says, stop attacking the Romans. There is a faction of the people who are like, no, you gave up. It's that simple. You gave up. I'm completely with the rabbis on this one, because there were a lot of rebellions against the Romans. The toll it took in terms of massacres of innocent Jews as retribution for the rebels was extraordinary. So the leaders did the right thing by saying, for God's sake, stop attacking the Romans. You know, when God's ready to free us from the Romans, God will free us from the Romans. But they did alienate mostly younger people who felt like, no, we got to rebel. So one of the things they did was they changed the story of Hanukkah to reflect, not changed it, they added in a miracle about oil that was not in the original story and commemoration to shift the focus away from military victory toward some folk miracle. It's not simple. I mean,
so now that more of that I think about it, when you say it that way, stop attacking, it's suicide every time. Actually, forget everything I said before.
No, it's okay. I was trying
to. The examples I was trying to narrow down in my mind to make sense. It's actually kind of like the Irish and the English. Time the Irish or Scottish and the English, and Scottish and Irish are trying to gain their independence of their land from the English, but every time they would attack, the English would. Massacre the villages.
Yeah.
Every time there was an attack on one of the forts in England. So yeah, I can totally understand.
It's a great example. And I was even thinking of the IRA and Sinn Féin is our IRA, like, because I grew up, I'm a little bit younger and I lived through a lot of that, which is on the one hand, there's always going to be a faction of like, no, you know, we're going to beat back those British if we just bomb them a few more times and we'll get our way. And yet the actual political leaders was like, no, every time we do that, the British come in, they take away our money, they level our cities, they bomb us. You know, like, people die.
Mm-hmm.
The responsible thing is, you know, peaceful something, you know, waiting. I mean, frankly, waiting. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, but, you know, and that's exactly what happens.
Why inflict more pain,
right.
Anguish, death? Upon us by...
And I'd say, I think a lot of people probably agreed with that, just like in Ireland. But I just wanted to point out that there was a whole faction of the Jewish... There was a small faction of the Jewish people called the Zealots.
Mm.
And they were angry at the rabbis for shifting the focus of Hanukkah and telling people not to rebel because they felt that it was giving up independence. It was giving up the fight for independence. Huh. But the rabbis were saying, we're postponing the fight for independence, that it's about timing and that the fight for independence is not today. Like we gotta wait, you know, and a lot of ways what they said paid off, which is that fighting the Roman Empire at its strongest was really bad timing. Eventually the Roman Empire started to break up through its own internal implosions. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The Neros and the Caligulas and the poor leadership. So in some ways, like we started this whole conversation, was about timing. It's all about how do you understand holy timing? And how do you create holy rhythms and timing in your life? And in a way, the rabbis were like, the timing is wrong for rebellion. Some people, the IRA part of the Jews at the time called the Zealots, were like, no, the time is today. The time is yesterday. You know, we got no time to spare. God's on our side. And the rabbis were like, no. Like, and in a way, the rabbis were right, which was waiting out the Romans was probably, I mean, I'm speaking glibly, but it was probably the right thing to do. So the meaning of Hanukkah shifted from military victory
to
Festival of Lights. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it occurs at the darkest time of year, when there's a pagan festival of lights and now a Christian festival of lights, like it sure seemed to be the Festival of Lights, the Festival of Fighting. Let me say one quick thing, which is that for the Beit Din, maybe, if they ask you, what's the human value that Hanukkah exemplifies, it is the freedom of what? What was forbidden in the fight? Like what was Hanukkah is the story of the Greeks. What did the Greeks do? The Greek Syrians?
They forbid them to practice their religion, Judaism. Yeah.
So freedom of religion. So remember, we already did freedom from oppression for Passover. Now we have freedom of religion in Hanukkah. And we have one more holiday, and then let's stop, at least the holidays. Okay. A couple months later, you have the holiday Purim.
Purim.
On Purim, you read the book of Esther from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And Esther is a Persian folktale. It's a story of... It says it's the story of Jews in Persia, where an evil man named Haman, H-A-M-A-N, advised the king of the time to persecute the Jews because they were different. The human value that Purim teaches us is, it depends how you want to put it, I'll just put it two different ways. Freedom from ethnic persecution. Mm-hmm. Or freedom of ethnicity. And you don't necessarily have to write it down, but let me just say something about that. The Purim story is very different from the Hanukkah story. Because what was outlawed in Hanukkah was not being a Jew, it was practicing Judaism. It was a religion. It was practice, religious practice. There is no mention of religious practice in all of the book of Esther. There's not even a mention of the word God. All it is a sense that in Persia, they're like, there are these Jews who live among us and they're different. They're a different genetic ancestry. Mm-hmm. They have a different language. They have different customs. There's no sense that they're a religion. It's just an ethnic difference, a racial ethnic difference kind of thing. And they're going to persecute them just because of that, because they're not Persian. So that it is a different value. It is a different right. It's not the right to be a Jew. It's the right to be ethnically different, the right not to be persecuted just because you have a different cultural customs. You have a different look. You know, you come from a different heritage. So there we have the three holidays that teach the big human values are Passover, freedom from being oppressed, like through labor or work, or ours. I mean, it's literal oppression. We were slaves. You know, it's oppression. Being starved. I mean, being made to suffer. Being oppressed. We have Purim, freedom to be an ethnicity of your choosing without being persecuted for it, just for being different. And and Hanukkah, the freedom of religious practice.
So let's say Purim means...
The word Purim actually means lots. It comes from a part of the story where they cast lots. But but I would say that the meaning of the word Purim is irrelevant.
Okay.
The hero of the story is a girl named Esther. Do you know the Purim story at all? The Esther story?
I read it like a long time ago in Sunday school when I was a kid, but never...
The quick version is this, which is the king has a beauty contest to hire a new queen, and he ends up with a girl named Esther, right? And he likes her. She's pretty. And she seems sweet. Meanwhile, evil Haman, his advisor, says, I'm having problems with this ethnic minority that lives among us called the Jews. And can you persecute them for me, like imprison them and do away with them? They're my business competitors and things like that. Mm-hmm. It would be the same thing like in Indonesia where people hate the Chinese. The Chinese who've lived there for generations, but they're ethnically different.
Right.
And so it's like, can you get rid of my Chinese business competitors? And the government often will do that because the government has a racial bias. They have a bigotry. So anyway, the king has the new wife. Young teenage girl, seems very sweet. Meanwhile, his advisor's saying, can you get rid of the Jews for me? That, you know, they're foreigners anyway, and there are too many of them now, and they're annoying, and we should just kick them out of the land, you know, kick them out of the kingdom. And the king says, sure, this is his advisor. No, who likes Jews anyway? They're different. And then Esther has to admit, she risks her life. It's the whole climax of the story. She risks her life, and she says, King, I need to tell you something. I'm Jewish. So she puts him in the position of having to choose. Is he going to get rid of her too? Or is he going to get rid of his evil advisor? And that's the climax. And the climax says, wait a second. I really like you. You're pretty. And you seem really nice. And you're Jewish. And why am I getting... And she's like, why am I... And he's like, why am I getting rid of the Jews anyway? Well, my advisor told me to. And she's like, he's an evil advisor. Get rid of him instead. And he says, okay. That's the end of the story. Well, actually, and then there's a massacre of Haman and his family. Mm. Has a very violent end. Happy ending. Happy violent ending. So it ends up being a kid's holiday. It's Jewish Halloween, where kids get to dress up as characters from the story, and we have fun. We celebrate a victory over persecution. But, I mean, the serious or whatever quality of the story is obvious, which is, when is it in life you're willing to stick your neck out, especially when you're, let's be simple. It's a story about when are you willing in your life to let people know you're Jewish? And the story is about a girl who was not a king, and she was not a leader, and she was not a soldier, she wasn't even a man. She was just a teenage girl who won a beauty contest. Nothing more. There's nothing more special about Esther. She's just a teenage girl who won a beauty contest. But she actually let someone know that she was Jewish. It could have cost her life, and instead it saved people. So, you know, one of the questions for our kids, when do you let people know you're Jewish? When are you going to put yourself in danger about that? When, you know, are you never going to? Are you going to do some of the time? Are you going to do all the time? But that's the real nub of the story is... for people who can pass as non-Jews, like almost any Jew today, when are you going to let people know? You know, it's a very personal decision. You know, like some people just let it go. Am I going to bring it up at the office Christmas party when everyone's wishing me Merry Christmas and the boss has given me my stocking, you know, and a ham? Or am I going to let it go? And the question is, what if you let it go all the time? Maybe there are no Jews left. There's no answer, you know what I mean? But the answer is when are you ever going to let people know if you are prone to not letting people know? I mean, some people wear a Jewish star around their neck and it's not a question. But for the majority of Jews today who assimilate, who don't live in the land of Israel. Yeah, no, what is it?
Shema Israel.
The Shema, right.
Yeah, that and also my ring.
Yeah. That's right.
And, you know, I actually have a bracelet. I have that Hasa Chamsa and the Star of David. And I represent. It's my
I like, because I like how it, I think it was one of the first studies we had, and you're talking about how you kind of used the example of like a tribe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm like, yeah, I mean, you just gotta, why should I be afraid to, you know, express who I am, what I stand for, what I believe in, versus somebody else who does. Like, somebody else can parade around with a cross on their neck or I mean, I did that when I was Christian. I was,
sure,
got, had a cross, you know, and shirts and stuff. I mean, it's just it's the person I am, or why should I be afraid to mention, like, to say the word, like, black guy or whatever the politically correct term, African American.
Right.
I mean, but then that person can turn around and say white, cracker, whatever, you know? It's like, come on. It's like reverse racism.
Yep.
So, but yeah, I mean, yeah.
Okay, so figure there are 8 holidays to know. Let me quiz you on some of them. Let's see how you do on an instant quiz.
Okay.
What holiday comes after Yom Kippur?
Let me turn.
No. And I'm going, you don't have to get them right.
So what holiday comes after Yom Kippur? Sukkot.
Very good. What's the main thing you do during Sukkot?
The main thing you do during Sukkot is to build a sukkah outside, and you eat, live, and possible sleep in it.
A+. That's perfect. What do you think the meaning of the sukkah is? Like, why that? It's not the most clear question, but what do you think the spiritual meaning is of living in a sukkah?
To realize what you need and don't need in life.
Beautiful, beautiful. And we have a little fiction in our tradition, a little legend, which maybe is playing with the facts, which is that who used to live in these?
Our ancestors.
Good.
Abraham.
Right. But what did they really live in?
They lived in a tent.
Right. Except for the farmer ones who sometimes lived in booths. Good. Nicely. 100%. A+. What holiday comes after Passover? The next big holiday.
Spring. So it's Passover and then it's Rosh Hashanah. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
In between.
No. There's an in-between one, which is
Passover is usually March or April, and there's one that comes at Memorial Day.
Yeah, which is
I can give you
Shavuot.
Good.
Shavuot.
Good.
Shavuot.
No. It's you don't have to pronounce it perfect. One of the ways to think about that is if Sukkot is coming out of Egypt and crossing the Red Sea, the next step is Mount Sinai.
Gotcha.
I mean, in the Torah.
Right.
So you're actually kind of the calendar is following the Exodus, believe it or not. It's kind of following the pattern. So anyway, so good. And what is the main idea of Shavuot?
It's to commemorate the giving, God giving us the Torah.
Great. And what is a traditional customary practice to do on Shavuot besides go to synagogue and do the prayers?
Customary thing to do on Shavuot is to
my hint is Starbucks.
Oh, not to drink or I'm actually, I don't remember.
It's been like it.
Gosh.
Is to stay up all night.
Oh.
And study.
I see where you made that connection.
No, it was the introduction of
to
coffee.
Stay up all night
and study.
And study the word.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Good. That's Shavuot. Right. What holiday usually comes in August? Well, okay. Different way. What are the 2 holidays you fast for? No eating or drinking.
Yom Kippur.
Good.
And Tisha B'Av.
Good.
Tisha B'Av.
Yeah, good. The 9th of Av. You can also do it in English, the 9th of Av, but Tisha B'Av. Very good. What does Tisha B'Av commemorate?
Tisha B'Av commemorates I'm trying to remember.
It's just one historical event. Well, it's actually four historical, but just one historical event is good enough. Okay, I can give you a hint.
Okay.
No, it's okay. Today we have the Land of Israel, and the Land of Israel was actually founded in approximately 1025 BCE, but who destroyed it?
Oh, it's to commemorate the loss of Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, and the temple to the Romans.
Right, which really marks the fall of the country. I mean, I'm trying to teach our teenagers this, and I'm not sure they really get it, which is absolutely miraculous that basically in our parents' lifetime, the Land of Israel was founded. Because we had Israel, and we lost it when the Romans destroyed it.
Yeah.
So we have a holiday that marks the destruction.
But I'd have to say Shavuot and Tishbah. Those are the two holidays that are new to me, because all the others are pretty much common.
Right. Okay, good. Well, let me ask you this then. You may be asked, you may not. What's your favorite holiday? You're allowed to answer that. It's an easy question by the Beit Din. But be prepared, so you know.
Okay, my favorite holiday.
And it can be anything, yeah. A Jewish holiday. Don't say Thanksgiving.
My favorite holiday is Halloween.
Exactly. No. If that's exactly
it's
one
Saint
of those.
It's St. Patrick's Day because I get to drink my face.
I once talked like a smartass to conversion, and it's like that's the wrong setting.
You know what? The last time you asked this, I was actually thinking about it. I didn't really like have one, because I kind of liked a few of them, but then I really thought about it more and more, and I just today after this study of going over the holidays, I kind of realized, I'm like, oh, you know what? That's my favorite is Sukkot.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because that's kind of how I look at life, you know, I like to create, I like to build. So for me to be able to create something in nature that, going to spend time, you know, with family and just really like understand what is really a necessity in life, what really it means, life and our travel and journey in life with God, being able to really observe what God's creation and not the material things that we create all the time that distracts us from that. So that for sure is my favorite.
Okay. Let's see. Let me check the time. It is 4:00. Mm-hmm. When do you have to go? It can be now. We can stop here.
Lerone was asking me when I was going to get out. I told you 30 more minutes. 30 minutes ago.
Right. So, we can stop. There's one other topic I could do, but we could wait until we see each other. I mean, this is a good time to stop. We did the holidays. This is a good time to stop. We're still meeting Wednesday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Up to you. Does that sound good?
Yeah, we can pick up because we have those are holidays.
Yeah. So I mean, the next thing I was going to do is Shabbat. I mean, do you want to try to do 10 minutes on Shabbat?
Let's see. Oh, I wouldn't mind. I just want to know. I don't know if Lerone had something.
Right. Exactly. No. Check with her. That's what I'm asking. You check with her.
Sometimes I hate texting.
I
just like, how much time am I gotta wait to text something and then wait for the response? I just like calling people. Which, by the way, Lerone said, thank you so much for all the stuff.
Sure.
We're so.
Oh. Yeah.